Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Sometimes, life changes in ways that we could never have expected.
Oh, it's cold. Yeah, it's very cold.
It's -3 degrees Celsius as 18-year-old Sara waits outside school. She was one of millions of people to seek asylum in Europe last year. Now she's in the rural north of Sweden. I'm Keith Moore, and welcome to the documentary on the BBC World Service. -3 is a warm day here in winter. On some days, it can get as low as -30. In December, the sun sets at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I'll tell you something. My dad is studying here.
Okay.
So if you want, he can go with us.
Okay, we'll all walk together.
Yeah.
That'd be nice. In the building next to the school, her father, Mohammed, studies Swedish. They've been in Sweden for 3 months.
It's difficult for us at the beginning, but now it's okay. We started to get used to this.
A new life. It's a big change for them, but also for the place they've moved to. Ånge is a community made up of small towns and villages. It's a 5-hour train journey north of Stockholm. It's where my wife is from and her parents still live. It's the kind of place you think of when you picture Sweden. Lakes, pine trees, and snow-covered hills dotted with red wooden houses. 9,500 people live here, and now so do 1,000 asylum seekers. So how's that working? Who are these new arrivals? What do the population think? Has the influx put a strain on public services? Well, that's what I've come to find out, starting with a 30-minute walk from school to Mohammed and Sara's new flat. It was on that chilly walk I discovered the grim irony of their own story. The family left Syria 4 years ago to escape the war and moved to Yemen, where Mohammed worked for an international NGO as a project manager.
Projects with refugees I was working.
Oh, you were working with refugees?
Unfortunately, you see how I was helping the people just to provide some support, let's say, psychosocial support for the refugees.
When war came to Yemen and the situation became dangerous, the NGO he worked for evacuated all of its international staff, but Mohammed wasn't eligible. And that's how a man who was helping refugees became one himself. Now he spends his days learning Swedish, which isn't easy for someone who spent a long time holding important jobs.
This is one of the difficulties to start learning. I am not a young man, so it will be very difficult to restart again studying, going to schools. And I have finished my university since more than 30 years.
The family were granted permits and came to Sweden. They were given an apartment where there was one available. It's not just the cold that came as a shock. They lived in Damascus and then Sanaa, so the move to a small community is also a big change. Where they live now is an hour from the nearest city. Sara was at high school in Yemen and wanted to go on to university to study to become an engineer. Now she's here, the only subject she's studying at the local school is Swedish.
The most important thing for us now, we are four, me and two daughters. For the two daughters, the most important thing is they have to learn, they have to study. This is very important. For us, we don't have anything. I don't have any properties, let's say. And you know, when land is gone and money is spent, then learning is most excellent.
I got to meet the rest of Mohammed and Sara's family when they invited me into their new home.
Hey.
Hey.
Keith, nice to meet you. Thanks for letting me into your home.
It was a clean, spacious flat on the first floor of an apartment block. Understandably, it was sparsely furnished. The sofa we sat on in the living room was donated by a member of the local community. Mohammed's wife Fatima made Turkish coffee and offered me fruit and biscuits. I was their guest. Maybe it felt like a little dose of normality for them in a new situation. Mohammed's older daughter Noor had to quit university in her final year when the family left Syria and start all over again in Yemen. She was just about to start her final year in Yemen when the family fled to Sweden.
It's difficult for me, but it's okay. I hope it will be better. And also I want, you know, to complete my studying This is the most important thing.
The family haven't made friends yet. The neighbours say hello and are friendly, but they haven't really had any conversations beyond pleasantries. They spend their evenings learning Swedish. They're thankful to be in Sweden, but, understandably, are impatient to get their lives back on track. Noor is like any 24-year-old who's lived in big cities and moved to a small place. She's eager to move somewhere bigger, go to university, make friends and start to rebuild the life she left behind, first in Syria and then in Yemen.
This apartment here is very nice though, isn't it?
It seems quite nice. Warm. We like it. We like it very much. A very quiet area. Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, a quiet area?
For me, it's bad.
Okay. Maybe because they are still young, you know, you need a vivid life, activities and friends and so on.
Exactly, but...
But if we can move this apartment with us, it would be fine.
So, yeah, you're used to living in big cities, aren't you? It's a big change coming here now.
Yes, yeah.
So they used to steal my car and go to the university.
Those memories of more carefree times seem to snap Mohammed back into the present, where he's waiting for the girls to be settled again and studying, living something more closely resembling a normal family life.
The big challenge is time, you know? It's time. Time is destroying us and stealing us, stealing our life, you know?
While time is moving slowly for Mohammed and his family, the pace of change feels different for the locals. A year ago, there were no more than a couple of hundred refugees in the community. Now, there are more than 1,000. But how do you even try to integrate that many people into such a small community? Volunteers are trying, like in this group, where locals try to teach Swedish to new arrivals in their village through lessons and song. It was there I first met Åke Nylén.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Good.
He was the one who came up with the idea of teaching the refugees Swedish. He was born in this community. He's in his 50s now. He's bald and has a moustache. Still broad-shouldered, but with the classic middle-aged spread. He's quick to laugh and always has a story to tell. He used to work as a guard at a maximum security prison. And before that...
I started out when I was 18 to work at a psychiatric hospital for the criminally insane. You were hired by how tall you were and how heavy you were. And I was 180 and 120 kilos. I was a weightlifter and I was the smallest guy in the whole ward. They called me Tiny.
As well as volunteering to help teach the new arrival Swedish, his day job actually involves working with refugees at a home for children under 18 who've travelled to Sweden unaccompanied. Last year, 35,000 children did just that. The majority of them were boys from Afghanistan. At the centre where Åke works, there are 15 residents, and they're all boys from Afghanistan, aged 14 to 16. He agreed to meet me one day and drive me to the centre so I could see it for myself.
We have one kid who was on a boat on the Mediterranean, and the boat ahead sank. So his boat has to go through the bodies that were floating in the water. And some of them have got real bad memories, which come to them at night sometimes. Some of them are often wandering about at night, you know, sit down and they cuddle up next to you. They want to sit as close to you as they possibly can.
The centre is in a block that used to be just normal flats and has been open since November. There's a kitchen, corridors with bedrooms and a main living area. There are plants on the windowsill and paintings on the wall. It's clean, homely, and when I arrive, it smells good too. The boys who've just got home from school are eating dinner around a table.
They're homemade food. It's made out of squashed tomatoes, onions and... beans.
Others are playing a football game on a console. They could be teenagers from anywhere.
On Tuesday it's just school and homework. On Wednesday, school, homework, youth centre.
On one of the walls, they have a timetable of activities.
Are there any activities here that they do with the Swedish-born local children?
Not that much, actually. Unfortunately, we haven't come around to that. Even at school, they keep themselves for themselves, and the Swedes keep themselves for themselves.
I guess it helps that they're all from the same country, they have the same values, probably the same religion and things like that.
And as in the beginning, there were a lot of praying. They prayed several times a day. But as time goes on, we see less and less of the praying and more of the football playing. And so I think the religion is not that rubbed into them.
Okay, so you think they're almost starting to become... Sweden's a very secular country. Can you see them almost becoming a little bit Swedish week by week?
I'm just waiting for a moment when they eat the fermented herring. You heard about that?
I've heard about it, but I haven't tasted it.
Oh, it's lovely. You'll love it.
16-year-old Kebid wandered past.
We came here for life. We came for living life in here. But in Afghanistan... just we haven't one thing, that's security. But here is security, good people, good everything is here good.
Sometimes I'm a grumpy old man, isn't I?
It's clear, just from spending a bit of time with Orky and the boys, he has a connection with many of them. And he not only wants to try to make them feel welcome, but he wants them to stay. After all, when he was young, the population of Ongye was double what it is now. And for the first time in a long time, it's growing.
We have a very strange development in age in this community, in the whole council. We have a lot of older people. There's an elderly population. So we need young people. We need people to come in. In 15 years' time, 50% of all people who are working here has retired. So we need to have people come from outside here to stay here and to get a job and really root themselves here. What's the alternative? Well, we're slowly dying. That's the alternative.
There's one fact I've left out so far about Orki. He's also a politician, vice mayor of the community, in fact. Orki welcomes new people arriving into the community, but here's the twist. The council has no control over how many arrive. That's because private individuals can buy property, tell the government they have space to take refugees who then get sent to the accommodation. The property owners get money from the government for housing the refugees, but the council has to provide all of the other services they require, such as education, dental care and healthcare.
What is the problem is they are not in any way communicating with the council. So it came as a huge surprise for us when there suddenly was 300 people in a small space.
There's now a market for it, and many, if not all, do it for a profit. The government has helped the council with extra money to provide services for 2015 and 16, but what comes after that time, when the community may have to pay, is something that concerns the Swedish Democrats. They're now the third biggest party in Sweden, with an anti-immigration message and a focus on Swedishness and Swedish values. They got nearly a fifth of the vote in this community during the 2014 election. It's unrealistic to think that everybody in the community is as enthusiastic about so many asylum seekers moving in such a short space of time as Orki. And no conversation about refugees in Sweden would be appropriate without hearing from the Sweden Democrats. So, in a local restaurant, I met one of the party's representatives, Stig Malmberg, who has lived in Ongye all of his 60 years.
It's too small community to take so much new people in 1 year.
Stig was with fellow Swedish Democrat Dennis, who was wearing a blue baseball cap emblazoned with the letters SD in white. They admitted that the Swedish population was ageing. However, they said many asylum seekers simply move away when they receive their residence permits. Here's Dennis.
More people is not the solution of the falling population. They move from here because of no work, so you need the work so they can do something.
I have talked with people near this camp for asylum seekers, and they are afraid to put their children on school bus. They go self with children. They are afraid.
Both say that local services have come under strain, and that's what I wanted to look at next, starting with the school, Bullberry's Gymnasiet.
Welcome.
The day I was at the school, it was the first day for 19 new students. There were 7 Arabic speakers, 8 Dari speakers, 1 Bengali, and 2 boys who spoke Somali. In a few weeks, another 25 students will be joining. The school, which is for pupils aged 16 to 19, has around 200 students. Before the summer, a quarter of them were non-Swedish born. Now, that figure is a third. So how has it been for some of the staff who work with the new students? Bo Ek is a recently qualified teacher.
It has been too much too quickly. Both the Swedish society, the government, and of course the schools are trying their best. They're working really, really hard right now to make sure that everyone gets the chance to learn Swedish. Unfortunately, there are more immigrants or new arrivals than we have people to work with, so to say. But right now, I mean, things are hard, but not impossible. Absolutely not.
And he's right. When you walk through the corridors, there really is a positive attitude around the school. They've adjusted the way they welcome new students on a number of occasions. And now there's a system where they spend 2 weeks learning what's expected of them before going on to take Swedish classes. They don't join in lessons with the Swedish-born pupils until their language skills are up to scratch. But because the foreign-born students are taking classes with each other, it's also noticeable that there's a divide between them. All of the staff at the school I spoke to acknowledged that more should be done to integrate the old and the new pupils.
I wish we could be more together, so we wouldn't have a us and them feeling.
Tuva and Alexandra are both 17 and have lived in this area their whole lives.
I think it's positive for this community to have more people here because everyone is moving away.
And how about in terms of your own schooling? Has it affected your learning and your school?
Well, we had some different rooms where we have our lessons, but other than that, nothing that is negative.
Do all of the students feel the same?
I think there is very many thoughts about it, and some like it and some doesn't like it.
How about, as young women, communicating with boys and things like that? Has that been an issue?
There are some guys, because I go to the place where people come, where they live, at the big Bulby, it's called.
And oh, is that the refugee center?
Yeah, exactly. And there, the guys, I know some younger guys around their 20s, and they want to get to know you, but they don't really know the difference between friend and a girl that they can do whatever they want with. So that's a bit scaring because they don't know the Swedish structure, sort of.
I mean, what do you mean by that? They don't sort of know the difference?
They want to come close to you, although you can feel uncomfortable, and you don't really know how to tell them that it's not okay because you don't want to be rude.
This community, obviously, it's a lot of people coming to a small place. But do you think overall people feel positive about it?
I think it's very positive. Like, the stores in this community is going better. And
I know my grandmother says, oh, it's so scary when new people come here. And I know it's the old way of thinking. But for the young people, if it happens, you don't know why it should be bad. So you don't have any reason to think it's bad before you.
So for family members who've lived here for a long time, older people, it's a harder change for them to make than for you guys, you think?
Yeah, they're old. Yeah. They don't like changes and just want everything to remain the same.
One of the busiest people in the school is its Arabic translator.
My name is Mohammed Elsheikh.
Originally from Sudan, he's been in Sweden for 4 years. He used to be a doctor for Doctors Without Borders. He'd only been working at the school for a couple of weeks. As someone who moved to Sweden not so long ago himself, he offers an interesting and somewhat sobering perspective.
Integration is, for those who come from Arabic countries, it's not so easy. And some of them, they are still conservative and they want to accept that they are living in a new country and they have to follow the new cultural needs and demands. I'm a Muslim, but I don't accept that.
Do you feel integrated in Sweden? Do you feel Swedish now?
Maybe I can say 60%, 75%. But it's a matter of time.
So we've heard from the school. What about the police? Sweden made international headlines recently with police in Stockholm being accused of covering up sexual assaults by migrants at a music festival. But the police in Ånge were very open with me. I called one morning and within a couple of hours I was in the station speaking to Inspector Krista Ost, one of six officers in the community.
We have more to do, yes. That's a fact.
I asked him what percentage of police time is now spent dealing with incidents involving refugees.
In our area, I think it's about between 30 and 50%.
So what types of things are you seeing? Is it locals and asylum seekers and refugees clashing, or is it the refugees and asylum seekers among themselves?
It's 95% among themselves. Sometimes they are arguing, and when we arrive, we can have them just talking, and that's it. And some other times, I think it's the bigger thing we have, and we have about two or three times, it's when they're fighting with knives.
Despite the increased workload, Krista certainly didn't think the local force was stretched beyond their limits. Getting used to people speaking different languages and having to use translators had made their job more difficult, and there's also been some cultural adjustments.
There was a refugee girl who would like to, maybe she would like to dress a little bit more Swedish. And there was some young man who reacted on this. So they started calling her things, and they made some other things too.
Do you feel prepared to deal with these types of cultural differences?
Me personally, no, I'm not. I'm not, because it's a bit hard to understand. For me, it is.
Do you think you've got enough support when it comes to these cultural differences and how to deal with them?
Right now, I don't think we have it, no. But I think my own firm, the police office, will understand that we need them, and I'm sure we will take care of and be better at it.
There's one village in particular where the police are called most often. It's a place called Torpshammar. In the middle of the village, there's a small supermarket, a school, a couple of petrol pumps, and, rather surprisingly, a 1950s-style American diner named Happy Days. A few hundred Swedes live here. Now, so do a few hundred asylum seekers. Most of them are young men, and the population has doubled. When I was there, it was bitterly cold, and not entirely obvious that hundreds of young men had moved to the village. Most people were indoors. I spent a day with a group of men from one of the refugee centres that has a good reputation in the community, and some of them invited me in for lunch.
Now we're going to feed you with the French fries and fish. That's going to be much faster.
Okay. Wow, thank you. Fish and chips.
Yes.
English style.
he's a good chap.
Inside, the corridors are painted bright purple. There's a lounge area with a TV and a space for Muslim residents to pray. They stay one or two to a room. The rooms are bright and clean and come with their own fridge. There are many Syrians and Eritreans and others from Sudan. There was a Kenyan and a Nigerian, and everyone was at different stages of the process of getting their residence permit. The influx of people into Sweden means there's now a backlog of applications and a longer waiting time. Some wait in hope and others in despair. In the kitchen, a group of Eritrean men were cooking in one corner. Others wandered in and out. It all seems like everyone's getting along. And it was there that I met a man who travelled from Damascus to Sweden a little over a year ago. He didn't want me to use his name on the radio for fears he could be identified back in Syria.
When I left Syria, I heard about that the laws in Sweden, the respect for the people here, the humanity here is like better than other countries. You know? There is no racism here.
Tell me about your life in Syria.
I was a student, college student. I study IT, information technology. Then the war comes up and I have to go to military. So I don't want to go to military. I just want to continue my study, live like a normal person.
What would you like your future to be?
I wish that I'll continue my study. Yeah, and live a happy life here, get married, have kids, like a normal life. We thank Sweden for everything. Sweden get all these people, that afford us houses, food, eat, safety. Safety is the most important.
How do you feel about Swedish people who might be unhappy about the number of refugees who've come to their country? What message would you have for them?
Well, I think the Swedish people has the right to do this. It's like a scary number, you know. It was like every week 10,000 people. That's a big number. And what they saw on media, on TV, it's war. So they thought like probably between these people, if there's only every week one bad person, that's a big problem for Sweden. We have to say like no, we are all good learned people, school people, we have good professions. They all escaped because they're afraid that I will die, you know. So here in Sweden, I think there is no reason to fear. If I or any Syrian here knows another one who will make problems here, they will go and tell the police.
His uncle also travelled with him. He's already received his residence permit to stay in Sweden.
I have like new life, you can say, you can call it like that.
And how about the Swedish people? Have you had a chance to speak to many people in the village?
Well, it was very classy. No, they are people of high standards of humanity, if you understand what I mean.
There are some people in Sweden who aren't happy about Sweden letting in so many refugees. Do you understand them?
Well, I understand what they feel. But what I want to tell them, Sweden doesn't stand for that. It's better than that. Well, my message is, put yourself in my shoes or in my place. What would you do? That's all.
In the tale of this small community, Sweden as a whole, and the huge movement of people to the country in 2015, the early chapters are still being written. Most people are under no illusions. It's a complicated situation. There's no doubt there are going to be many twists and turns over the next few years. But from most Swedes and the new arrivals, there's optimism. And if there is going to be a happy ending, that sense of positivity will have to be in large supply as the story unfolds. That's all from A Swedish Tale with me, Keith Moore. To hear more stories from the series, go to bbcworldservice.com/documentaries.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.